Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar sponsored by the Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, and the Litigation Practice Group for this Courthouse Steps discussion of the recent oral arguments heard in Learning Resources v. Trump. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an assistant director with the Federalist Society's Practice Groups and Networks. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not of the Federalist Society. If you have any questions for our speakers throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature, not the chat, so that we'll be able to access them when we get towards the close of our webinar. Adam White will start off our discussion today. Adam is the Lawrence H. Silberman Chair in Constitutional Governance and Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. With that, I will turn things over to our speakers to start the discussion. Adam, I believe you're up first.
Great. Thanks, Libby. Thanks to the Federal Society, and thanks, everybody, for joining us today. I'll introduce my friend and fellow speaker, Professor Adler, in just a moment. But first, let me tee up the topic at hand. As you know, we're here to discuss the case of Learning Resources versus Trump, a case involving interpretation of the International Economic Emergency Powers Act of 1977. Case has been rocketing through the federal courts and the Supreme Court throughout the year, and the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on November 5th. No decision yet, of course, but we may hear from the court in months or maybe even weeks. Now, the case, of course, centers around President Trump's reciprocal tariffs, the tariffs that he began imposing, I believe, on what was called Liberation Day back in the spring, and which have been sort of made and remade at various points throughout the year. The stakes of the case, of course, are enormous. They go both to questions of presidential power, Congress's power of the purse, and markets both at home and abroad. But legally speaking, the question before the court, the main question, is actually pretty specific. The question is about how to interpret a word in the U.S. code. And the word, of course, is regulate. The International Economic International Economic Emergency Powers Act, let's just call it IEPA, gives the president various powers in international trade to imports. And among those powers is the power to regulate. Now, the statute doesn't explicitly mention tariffs, at least not precisely. But the question is whether that term regulate implicitly includes the power to impose tariffs. The challengers to the tariffs, argue that regulations and tariffs are two different things, and that if Congress had intended to vest the president with a tariff-making power, Congress would have done it more explicitly. The Justice Department, on behalf of the president, argues that the most natural way to read the word regulate in this context is that it includes the power to impose tariffs as a form of trade regulation. And now I'll turn it over to Jonathan, to Professor Adler, to describe the arguments in a bit more detail, and I'll be back with a little commentary of my own. But first, let me introduce Professor Adler. He is the Cabell Research Professor and Tazewell Taylor Professor of Law at the William & Mary Law School, where he just arrived recently after many distinguished years at Case Western. He's a prolific author. His books include Business and the Roberts Court, which came out a few years ago. He now writes for the Civitas Outlook down at the University of Texas. And of course, he's a longtime contributor to the Volokh Conspiracy blog. He also writes for a number of other publications, including the Wall Street Journal and the Dispatch. And I mention those two publications in particular because his commentary on this case has appeared in those publications. And I hope you will look them up. Well before oral arguments, back in September, he published a piece in the Wall Street Journal titled "Why the Supreme Court Could Uphold Trump's Tariffs." And then more recently, after oral arguments, he published a piece in the Dispatch titled "Supreme Court Greets Trump's Sweeping Tariffs with Skepticism And I think those two commentaries give a good sense of how Professor Adler will approach this today. The first piece focused on presidential power in national security and foreign affairs, terrain that's very friendly to presidents, historically speaking. But in the dispatch, he summarized a lot of skeptical or critical questions that the Justice Department received at oral arguments. So without any further ado, let me turn it over to Professor Adler. Thanks for joining me. I should have said, by the way, he clerked for Judge David Sentell, who happens to be my favorite judge as well. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Adam. It's certainly great to be here. I want to say a little bit about what we saw at oral argument. And I think, you know, there's a benefit of being able to think about the oral argument with the opportunity to have reflected on it a little bit and not just the instant takes that we got the day of. So as Adam mentioned, there was a fair amount of skepticism of the administration's arguments at the oral argument in Learning Resources versus Trump. My own sense is there are two reasons why we saw that emphasized so much, including by myself in the immediate commentary on the argument. One is that this is the first case in which the Supreme Court is considering a second Trump administration policy on the merits, right? There have been a lot of orders considered on the interim docket or shadow docket or whatever you want to call it, the non-merits docket, where the Trump administration has had a lot of success. But we're only beginning this term to see cases that are involving merits challenges to Trump policies or Trump actions. We have this case later this term. There will be cases involving removal. And many of us expect there will be the court will also consider birthright citizenship. So as a result, there's been a lot of focus on the way the justices were approaching the Trump administration. And the fact that the administration has done so well on the interim docket, I think, made some people focus particularly on the skepticism expressed to the Solicitor General. I think a second reason is it was a long argument, and there was a lot of skepticism of the Solicitor General, and that caused people to focus their attention on that, even though there was also skepticism of the arguments against the administration. I want to highlight a couple things that I think are worth focusing on in the argument, and certainly the things that I've been paying attention to. But just to step back for a second, it is important to note just a couple other little things, right? One is these are multiple cases that were consolidated, one from the Federal Circuit, one from the District Court. There are a bunch of kind of moving parts in this litigation that got almost no time at oral argument that the court will almost certainly address. So, for example, whether or not these sorts of challenges get filed in the Court of International Trade or in a district court, some of the remedial questions and the like, perhaps even whether the states had standing or people other than those directly paying the tariffs have standing, I think the court may want to reach. As a technical matter, in this case, there are questions about whether or not this is an emergency, or as the statute defines it, an unusual or extraordinary threat, which has its source in whole or substantial part outside of the United States. That's technically in this case, but it got very little airtime in oral argument. And I think one reason for that is neither the challengers nor the justices are particularly interested in trying to second guess what the basis is upon which a president declares something to be an emergency and how one quantifies that. And a reason for that, and I'll come back to this, is that any decision the court makes about a question like that has repercussions beyond this case. So even though many of us, myself included, do not think longstanding and persistent trade deficits or the decline in American manufacturing constitute an unusual or extraordinary threat or the sort of emergency that would justify use of the statute, there is a question about opening the door to second-guessing a president's ability to make that sort of determination, because there are lots of contexts, and perhaps the other tariffs at issue in this case, those involving trying to induce international cooperation on control of fentanyl, may sometimes turn on things that are not public, that are not probably before the court, that involve information the executive branch has that the public doesn't have at large. And so I think the court is very wary of opening that door. And if you look at the way the challengers presented this case, they preserved the argument, but really did not ask the court to focus on that. So with all that out of the way, as Adam noted, the real focus of oral argument is whether or not the power to regulate the importation of any property in IEEPA allows for tariffs. It clearly allows for embargoes, for freezes on imports, for the adoption of quotas, the imposition of import licenses. The question is whether or not it allows for the imposition of a tariff. And as noted, I think there was a fair amount of skepticism about that and whether or not it could be so broadly. Although at the same time, there was, I think, some resistance or reluctance to interpret the statute too broadly in the other direction, right? That I think multiple justices asked questions in a way that suggested that something that limits the executive branch's authority but is not an all-or-nothing choice is something that they might prefer. Now, my own view is that this case likely comes down to the Chief Justice and the Trump appointees to the court. I think the Democratic appointees on the court, they showed incredible skepticism of the, if not hostility, to the Solicitor General's arguments. I think in general are likely to be skeptical of the Trump administration. And Justices Alito and Thomas historically have not only been supporters of broad executive power, but I think in their questioning also indicated more sympathy to the executive branch. That doesn't mean that those five justices' votes are predetermined, but it does suggest to me that for the challengers or the government to prevail, they need to convince a majority of the Chief Justice and the Trump appointees. And so I wanted to highlight a few things we heard in their questioning that I think are interesting, and I think in many respects are all very consistent with what we'd expect from each of these justices. So the Chief Justice asked some questions repeatedly, suggesting that this should be seen as a major questions case. The Chief Justice has clearly been very interested in the major questions doctrine. He's written the majority opinions in Biden versus Nebraska, in West Virginia versus EPA. He's written other opinions, like his dissent in City of Arlington versus FCC and his opinion in King versus Burwell, which suggests this theme that he is very concerned about reading statutes to broadly delegate authority to the executive branch. Not that the Congress can't do it, not that Congress wouldn't do it, but that we need to be somewhat concerned about blank checks. Now, his questions also, I think, acknowledged and brought out arguments that in the foreign affairs context or in the emergency context, we might expect Congress to delegate more broadly. But he certainly indicated that he saw this that way. There were also some exchanges where he showed his concern that the Trump administration might be relying upon some precedents a little too much. There was a particular exchange that I highlighted in my dispatch piece about a case called Deems and Moore versus Regan, a case which the court both read IEEPA narrowly and rejected the government's kind of specific IEEPA arguments, but nonetheless upheld what the Reagan administration sought to do. A fun fact is that Chief Justice Roberts clerked for Justice Rehnquist, the author of that opinion, the year that case came down. And so I think a lot of us raised our eyebrows when the Chief Justice suggested to the Solicitor General that he was interpreting Deems and Moore versus Regan too broadly. Justice Gorsuch, also very interested in the major questions doctrine, but unlike the Chief Justice and perhaps Justice Barrett, views the major questions doctrine as a way of enforcing and giving life to non-delegation concerns. Gorsuch suggested that he was sympathetic to some other arguments, certainly those raised by Alito, that the text alone is not enough for the challengers, and that you need to bring the major questions doctrine or non-delegation concerns to the table in order for them to get there all the way. And that, you know, both creates an opportunity and a risk for the challengers. The opportunity is that Justice Gorsuch, in an opinion this past term in a case called Consumers Research, did stress the need for there to be limits on any sort of taxing power, any sort of power to generate revenue that is delegated to the executive branch. On the other hand, both the major questions doctrine and the non-delegation doctrine have traditionally been applied more loosely in the context of foreign affairs. Something else I think is significant is that Justice Gorsuch really did flag what another administration might do with the sort of power the Trump administration highlighted if the Trump administration were to win, giving the hypothetical of a future administration declaring climate change to be an extraordinary and unusual threat that is largely or has its source from outside the country, and then using that to impose tariffs on, say, automobiles and the like. I actually think the hypothetical there is broadly more is broader than that. I think that a future administration, if the Trump administration prevails, could simply impose a border adjustment tax for carbon and essentially adopt a universal carbon fee on all international economic transactions with every country in the world under the Trump administration's theory. And the SG more or less conceded that a future administration could do that. He insisted the Trump administration wouldn't, but that a future administration could. And I think that was an important concession and argument. Really quickly, let me just go through Kavanaugh and Barrett. Justice Kavanaugh, I think, showed a little more sympathy to the Trump administration than did the chief or the other Trump appointees, and is really concerned both about executive power in the context of foreign affairs, but also the relevant precedents. There aren't a lot, but the Nixon administration did impose universal tariffs for balance of payment concerns. That was upheld by a lower court, relying upon language in the Trading with the Enemy Act, which mirrors the language in IEEPA. And there was some discussion about whether or not that means that a future administration has to be able to do what the Nixon administration did, or whether it means that this particular language allows that. Because one argument that the respondents have, and that was raised in a brief submitted by some former trade officials, is that the authority to do what Nixon did exists, but in other statutes, not in IEEPA, or not in this way under IEEPA. But he was very focused on those precedents. Justice Barrett, very focused on the text. You know, where Justice Gorsuch thought seemed to indicate he thought the text runs out and you need non-delegation or major question doctrine to do some work for the challengers to get where they want to go. Justice Barrett seemed to think that the way the text has been traditionally applied and understood might be enough for the challengers. She asked whether or not there was any example of any statute using this language to justify tariffs, whether it had been relied upon that way and the like. And the Solicitor General didn't really have any arguments. The Nixon era precedent of the Trading with the Enemies Act. What's interesting there is that Nixon forswore reliance upon that language when imposing the tariffs. It was only later in court that the Justice Department pointed to that language as the justification. And there's another case called Algonquin, where, as Justice Barrett noted, the language is quite different. She also was concerned whether or not there are other ways for the administration to essentially do what it's doing, in which case it would seem to perhaps be counterproductive to say they couldn't do this as a regulation. So, for example, could you require import licenses and then charge fees? And wouldn't that essentially be the same thing? So I think, you know, in those four justices, you can see arguments why a majority of them could go in either direction. And I think a lot of that comes down to whether or not they see this case as what I would characterize as a delegation case, not a non-delegation case, but a delegation case, a case that's really asking what power did Congress give? What power did Congress understand it was turning over? Did the executive branch understand it was receiving? Did the public understand it had been delegated? And insofar as the case is focused on that, kind of in the traditional mold, that's favorable to the challengers. But insofar as these particular emergency and foreign affairs concerns are on the table, and certainly both Justice Kavanaugh and Gorsuch showed some concerns there, that's more favorable to the administration. Bottom line, I think the challengers should feel a little better about the case after argument than perhaps they might have going in. But it's still a case that could come out in either direction. And I will stop there, Adam, and see what you thought and what else we should talk about.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. That was great. And I agree with a whole lot of it. I'll just add a few other points. And picking up where you left off, actually, I think that was exactly the right way to think about the competing frames for this case. I wrote a piece, folks, for what it's worth, for SCOTUS blog shortly before oral arguments, where I said that there's a choice of basic frames here. Will the court see this predominantly as a case of presidential power abroad? Or will they see it primarily as a case of Congress's power of the purse at home? Now, of course, the answer is it's both of those things, which is why it's a complicated case. But throughout oral arguments, and especially early on, you saw a lot of pressure from justices on the Justice Department to disabuse them of the notion that, in effect, the president was encroaching upon Congress's power of the purse. I do want to say, as Jonathan pointed out, that for those who were watching or listening to oral arguments closely in real time, I was live blogging of all things. I do think there's a tendency to take those initial questions, the skeptical questions, and allow that to color one's opinion of the remainder of oral arguments. There were critical questions from start to finish for both the Solicitor General first and then later for Neil Katyal, the former Solicitor General for President Obama, and then the Solicitor General of, correct me if I'm wrong, Jonathan, was it Ohio, your former?
Oregon.
I was close. On behalf of all Iowans who are always confused with Idahoans, I now feel terrible for confusing Ohio and Oregon. But I'll just say this was the basic frame from the start. And I think that on the whole, and Jonathan might disagree with me, but I think on the whole, this still felt by the end as the justices were thinking more in terms of, is this a delegation case? Is this a risk that Congress did not delegate away this much power to the president? Although, of course, again, the justices, especially, say, Alito and Kavanaugh, were explicitly raising questions about how to read this statute in the context of foreign affairs and emergencies. That was the basic frame. And I'll also agree with Jonathan and say a lot of people came to oral arguments, I think, a lot of pundits, not understanding that what's happened so far in the court this year around presidential power is not a clear signal of what would happen next, that these shadow docket orders or interim docket or emergency docket, that those orders had much more to do with prudential judgments as to when the court should intervene in a given case, and not the court's view of the merits. I saw some punditry right before oral arguments, maybe in the New York Times and Politico, suggesting, oh, the conservative justices will have a real hard time with this case because they've spent all year waving presidential actions through a green light. And I thought that punditry probably said more about the pundits than about the justices. And I thought that what you saw here was a much clearer view of how the justices, both the conservative and progressive justices, are grappling with substantive questions of presidential power. And I would distinguish that, by the way, in cases about presidential removal power. I tend to think that for 15 years, the Roberts Court has drawn a pretty sharp line between the who cases, who can the president fire, and the what cases, what policies can the president's administration advance. And all the while, for 15 years, they've been repeatedly reaffirming, maybe even expanding presidential power, constitutional power to fire officers or fire agency heads. On the substantive policy side, they've been squeezing presidents repeatedly, from Obama to Trump to Biden to Trump, including the major questions cases. Now, I don't know whether the justices will make this a major questions doctrine case. There were some interesting academic questions about whether the major questions doctrine applies on matters of foreign policy and so on, or whether it applies to the president's actions in the same way that it applies to agency actions. As somebody who thinks who's thought a lot about the major questions doctrine, I do think that those sorts of questions were maybe overdoing it a bit, that the court may well not use the magic words major questions doctrine, but that their interpretation of the statute may look a lot like the way they're interpreting that they apply the major questions doctrine. Although I am very curious to see if Justice Kagan writes separately, either as a concurrence or a dissent, on the major questions doctrine, because until now she's been very critical of the doctrine. But now we'll see how she might apply it if she's in a majority that has that kind of approach to statutory interpretation I'm Catholic, so I can make this joke. Sometimes people say, do you believe in baptism? I say, believe it. I've seen it done. And so now the question for Justice Kagan might not be so much, does she believe in the major questions doctrine? She's now seen it done repeatedly. And I'll be curious to see how she applies it. Just a few other sort of rambling notes here, but I agree with Professor Adler. I don't think the court is going to get into the sort of factual or quasi-factual questions of whether this is an emergency or not. I would frankly be stunned if the court used this case as the opportunity to start micromanaging presidents on whether an emergency exists. But by the same token, I was surprised to see the Justice Department lean so heavily into that question in their briefing, basically telling the court that a president's emergency declarations are unreviewable by the courts. They said that, and their fallback position was, well, if they're reviewable, it's under enormous deference. For me, that seemed to ratchet up the stakes of the real legal question at hand about how the court should think about the president's powers in an emergency, how to interpret the powers in the statute. Because if the Justice Department's position is that emergencies are unreviewable, that might instill some skepticism in the justices as to how to read the substantive powers a president can wield in an emergency. I think a couple of the justices, at least one, although I can't remember who, maybe Sotomayor or Kagan, flagged that question. And I wonder if maybe the Justice Department's pushing so hard on the emergency, unreviewable emergencies question might have slightly shot themselves in the foot. Now, just really quickly on a few justices I was watching through oral argument. I agree 100% with Professor Adler's account of Barrett and Kavanaugh. And I thought that was an interesting window into their slightly different approaches to textualism. You don't want to read too much into oral argument questions. It's the easiest way for us to get our legal punditry licenses revoked. But I thought it was interesting how Justice Barrett kept asking for examples from other statutes, right? Interpreting this provision with an eye to the broader body of laws that Congress has passed. Slightly different, I think, maybe more than slightly different than Justice Kavanaugh, who was very interested in what the Nixon administration thought it was doing and when he imposed tariffs under the older act, the Trading with the Enemies Act. And then relatedly, what did Congress make of what the Nixon administration did when it wrote this statute in 1977? So Justice Kavanaugh's textualism here was really focused on Congress's sense of previous administrations, whereas Barrett's textualism, at least in these questions, and again, let's not overdo it, but in these questions, Justice Barrett was very interested in Congress's sense of what it had done elsewhere, what Congress had done elsewhere. I thought that was an interesting and subtle distinction. Justice Alito, he had great questions as always. He seemed very wary of broad theories of how to frame this case. To my earlier point, for one side to be saying this is a power of the purse case and the other side say, no, this is a delegation case. Justice Alito seemed wary of making too much rest on those broad sweeping categorizations of the case. And he kept asking over and over again, you know, this is an emergency power statute that touches on foreign affairs. Should we really read it so narrowly that in no circumstance ever a president could impose a tariff? And he had some hypotheticals. Very characteristic, I think, of Justice Alito's very practical-minded approach to oral arguments. But I would add, I'm curious what he does with the non-delegation point, because he's never really grabbed onto that issue with both hands. In an older case, the Gundy case, he really sort of bristled at the notion that a textual argument over a kind of eccentric, we'll call it extraordinary, singular criminal law statute should be the locus of a broad generational debate over non-delegation, or at the very least, he bristled at the idea of creating a new non-delegation standard for that statute without really thinking non-delegation more broadly. I'm kind of curious if he would use this case perhaps as his own sort of coming out party on delegation. Like his arrival on the scene in these delegation debates in a way that he just really hasn't done before. So I'm very curious whether he rules for the tariffs or against the tariffs. And he seemed among the two more sympathetic views on the tariffs, sympathetic to the administration. I'll be curious what he says, if anything, about non-delegation. And that brings me to the other justice, Justice Thomas. Over and over again, oral arguments across the board, not just his questions, reminded me of his opinions in the Guantanamo cases 20 years ago. He had a great opinion. I think it was in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. It was a statutory case. And he said, look, for these kind of statutes, presidential authority abroad, it's natural to read Congress's statutes broadly. That's the natural way to read the statute. That line of thinking might not just resonate only with him and with Justice Alito, but it might also resonate with Justice Kavanaugh or Barrett. Overall, this felt to me like a 6-3 or 7-2 case. And as I pointed out in, I've got a little newsletter for AEI, I pointed out afterwards, I'd probably be more surprised by a 5-4 decision, whether it's for or against the administration, than a 9-0 decision against the administration. I'm not saying 9-0 against the administration is likely. I don't think it is. But I'd say it's more likely than a real knife's edge 5-4 decision either way. The center of gravity here feels like 7-2 or 6-3. And if I had to go to DraftKings on this one, I would probably pick 7-2. I think in the end, Kavanaugh seemed more likely to wind up with on the anti-tariff side of the case, although I think my friend Professor Adler might disagree. If I had one last bit of rank punditry, this feels like a Chief Justice Roberts opinion. As Jonathan mentioned, he's been one of the two leading voices on this court, and especially in terms of majority opinions, he has been the leading voice on this court for 15 years on both the president's removal power side of things and also on the president's substantive powers or the agency power side of things. My guess is that Chief Justice Roberts would write this majority opinion, although you can imagine him assigning it to Justice Kavanaugh if a narrow opinion is would keep Justice Kavanaugh in the majority. So I'm sort of waiting for maybe a mid-December opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts or Justice Kavanaugh. But again, having a lot of predictions based on oral arguments questions is the easiest way to get your pundit card revoked. And I've probably done that here. Jonathan, what would you disagree with on what I said?
I actually agree with most of that. I do think a 6-3 in favor of the respondents is a little more likely than 7-2. I might even say 8-1 or unanimous is more likely than 7-2. That is to say, I think, I'm just not sure, I think where in terms of where I see the breakpoints. But I agree with you, the Chief Justice, I think, is going to write. I think he's going to write however it comes out. And, you know, not only is this an area where he's, because it involves executive power, where he's really been the primary author and had a lot of concern, but he's also shown a lot of flexibility, right? If one looks at his opinion in West Virginia versus EPA, and his opinion in Biden versus Nebraska, they're very different opinions, right? They deploy major questions in very different ways. And he's shown a flexibility in terms of how he puts things together if he thinks it's necessary to hold a majority.
Jonathan, I'll just jump in. Jonathan, let me just say, that's a great point. I love that. And it reminds me of his approach in the early major questions doctrine. After dissenting in City of Arlington, right? There was a very good law review article written, I'll say, before City of Arlington on why the court should not defer to an agency's interpretation of its own jurisdiction. Chief Justice Roberts dissented when the court didn't go along with that finally written law review article theory. But then a lot of that ethos of that dissent wound up showing up, of all places, in his majority opinion in King v. Burwell, where he ruled in favor of the Obama administration on the merits of a legal question, but with an enormous reduction in Chevron deference that was a forerunner to the major questions doctrine. I didn't mean to cut you off. I had to.
I agree with that. Some things you mentioned that I thought I'd flag. And you mentioned Justice Kagan, and it was certainly, you know, we saw, I listened to the oral argument again yesterday just to refresh myself on some of this. And it's interesting is that pretty much every justice was kind of on script for what we expect from them in this case. And Adam, you noted some examples of that. So, for example, with Justice Kagan, there were multiple points at which she was clearly trying to buttress kind of the theoretical framework for some of the arguments, right? So she noted that the source of the intelligible principle doctrine for non-delegation comes from a case involving tariffs, J.W. Hampton. And so there were things like that that suggested she was trying to find a way for there to be a rationale that more than five justices could support. And I could certainly see her joining an opinion, for example, where the court uses non-delegation concerns as a means of encouraging constitutional avoidance and major questions on that basis. Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson, I don't think we're doing quite as much, certainly not as nimbly as Justice Kagan in terms of finding ways of supporting the outcome they wanted. Justice Jackson spent a lot of time on legislative history, which I think it's pretty clear she is the justice that's more interested in that than any other justice. You're not going to build a majority talking about legislative history on this court, but she nonetheless wanted to talk about that. So some things throughout that I'd love your reaction to, since I agree with a lot of your comments. One is, it didn't get talked about, but we know that in this case, it both involves the reciprocal tariffs that are basically global, and then these fentanyl tariffs. Yeah. And we can certainly imagine the Chief Justice liking the idea of preserving something or leaving something in play. And so I'd be curious if you see that as a possibility. Again, we didn't hear much about that at argument. So we have to kind of think about the court and the way it operates. But could you, for example, imagine the court saying the reciprocal tariffs, that doesn't fall within IEEPA, but perhaps in the context of the fentanyl tariffs, a remand, because perhaps the administration could identify a basis for upholding them. The problem with doing that is it does run headlong into the argument that the challengers really place a lot of weight on, which is the word regulate just does not include the power to tariff. And that's that would hamper that sort of resolution. But it is something that I think, if we're thinking about how the Chief Justice cobbles together a majority, was something that I thought might play. Another thing I was curious about is, there are a couple of academic amicus briefs that I think are potentially important in this case, too, that got mentioned at argument. There's the brief by Aditya Bhamsai that the Solicitor General referenced, which talks about some of the history of the language in IEEPA and how these powers were traditionally understood. There's the brief that Professor Rick Hills wrote on behalf of Wolf and Hills that really goes into the history, particularly with regard to the Nixon administration, that Neil Katyal referenced as the Marshall McLuhan moment, for those of you that are old Woody Allen fans. But where Wolf was the person there working with President Nixon on those tariffs. A third academic amicus brief, which I wonder might matter. And I'm highlighting these three briefs because in this case, there were dozens of amicus briefs, most of which serve no purpose other than signaling to the justices that particular groups care about the outcome. But in terms of substantively, there are really only a handful of briefs that I think actually are going to inform us. But there is a brief that Connor Clark at Washington University St. Louis submitted talking about how to understand the power to tax and impose tariffs. And one of the reasons I'm flagging that brief is it relies a decent amount on a law review article by one of your predecessors at the Gray Center, then professor, now Judge Jennifer Mascott, pointing out that in the founding period, Congress was very, very reluctant to give tariff power to the president, gave a lot of foreign affairs power, but Congress was very, very engaged. And I wonder if that's going to have much impact, because it might suggest that 20th century practice of being fairly loose with not merely foreign affairs delegations, but tariff delegations might look differently if we think about founding era practice, where the power to delegate tariffs generally was not delegated, and where Congress really micromanaged tariffs. So I'd be curious for your thoughts on either of those two
Great points. And I'd say on that last question, I mean, I think it is a key point about what the early Congress thought it was doing and how, and how much discretion or not it could give to the president. The challenge with that line of argument is Congress started changing gears very early on this, right? Arguably the first non-delegation question in the Supreme Court, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, was it Cargo of the Brig Aurora was the name of it? It had to do with a trade act from about 1809, in the run-up to the War of 1812, where Congress delegated enormous power to presidents to decide whether trade with England, whether England or France was treating us unfairly in trade. And he could flick, if they had light switches back then, you'd say, could flick the switch between high tariffs and low tariffs. By the end of the 19th century, we've got the statutes at issue in Field versus Clark. For the Midwesterners here, that Field is Marshall Field, the old department store. And it was a huge, huge tariff case where the Supreme Court allowed Congress to delegate broad power to the president. Now, that's long after the Washington administration, but the 1809 statute was not so long after that. And so I do wonder which way that'll cut. On the fentanyl...
I think on the Brig Aurora case, I mean, I'm pretty sure that was really an embargo case, not a tariff case. And this issue came up a bunch in the oral argument. And, you know, as someone, you know, as a formalist, I can make the argument that tariff is just a different sort of power than a quota, sure, embargo, any other limitation, because it has the same trade and foreign policy effects. It just adds money to the treasury.
Sure.
It arguably imposes on people domestically differently. And if the justices find that distinction, and this relates to one of the questions we got in the Q&A box, find the distinction significant, you could see an opinion that says, if you want to embargo, you want to impose quotas, you want to shut off trade altogether, have at it. Sure. You just don't get a line to the treasury, a revenue to the treasury, because that is just categorically different. And so you could see an opinion that is very pro-executive power in many ways, just not here. I think Brig Aurora is consistent with that, but I take your broader point that in the 19th century, Congress did begin to delegate tariff power, and there's a lot of historical practice that needs to be cabined to swallow the respondent's full argument that regulate doesn't include tariffs. But so that,
yeah, and I agree with everything you just said right there. And I again, as somebody who thinks the basic frame is a choice between Congress's power of the purse and the president's power abroad, and that tariffs, there is something qualitatively different about tariffs that bring in revenue that the president can then spend. Something that constitutionally goes to the heart of other constitutional provisions that tried to keep the power of the purse, not just in Congress, but in the House, because of its closeness to the people. I think that's an interesting distinction. On the fentanyl question, yeah, I thought it was interesting that the Solicitor General led off the oral argument, I think, by focusing on the fentanyl crisis rather than a broader trade crisis, and really leaned into that. I could see perhaps that sort of better representing the national security stakes than President Trump's criticism of trade practices, or as we saw in the eve oral arguments, an Ontario political ad, which I think was probably in the minds of a lot of the justices as they heard oral arguments. It's, as you said, I think it's too hard a distinction to draw in interpreting the statute. Now, you also alluded to the Q&A, and we already have great questions. We got eight of them. So let me jump into those, Jonathan. I'm going to start with two questions that touch on a similar subject. The first question that came in was from John DiLorenzo. He said he's asking about the refund issue. If the plaintiffs prevail, how will those who paid small amounts of tariffs be able to afford a lawyer or agent to get through the process? Are class actions available? And then relatedly, a question from anonymous attendee, if that is your real name, points to Justice Barrett, saying that the refund process could be difficult to administer. I think she might have used the word mess, right? Did she say, yeah. What happens if the court does bring things back to refunds? How will this play out? How does it dovetail with the court's recent decision on nationwide injunctions, Trump v. CASA? So broadly, Jonathan, I guess I'd ask two questions. One is, do you think the court in this decision will give clarity to the refund issue And second, do you have any guess on what refunds would actually look like in the process if the Trump administration loses? And again, let's be clear here. We don't know that it's going to lose. It may well win. But I tend to think it's more likely that the administration will lose the legal question. What happens then on the remedy?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things. We noted there was no discussion at oral argument about the jurisdictional questions, but I certainly anticipate the court saying that the Court of International Trade was the proper place to file these claims, not the district courts. It's another way of cutting district courts out of these sorts of questions, avoiding some of the nationwide injunction sorts of questions. I think when the justices look at it, I think they will recognize that there is a process through which importers who believe they were improperly tariffed can seek a refund. It's a longstanding process. It exists. It's not the nicest process. It's not the easiest process, but it is the process that Congress created. Congress anticipated that there could be tariffs that could be imposed improperly or wrongly or without adequate authority. And just as with other sorts of taxes, Congress created a mechanism where you can get a refund. And the administration relied upon the existence of that process when it opposed a stay and wanted a stay of the lower court ruling, imposed, you know, freezing the tariffs while the litigation unfolded. So I think if the challengers win, I think the court's going to hold the administration to that. And I think what that means as a practical matter is that the challengers here get their refunds. Other challengers might. But it'll take time and process. I think smaller importers will have a harder time. I don't know whether or not there's a way to do a class action in this sort of process, but I'm skeptical. It reminds me of the sort of questions about, you know, class actions in the context of arbitration provisions and whatever else. I mean, you'd really have to look at the mechanics of how that works, and that I haven't focused on that. But I think the court will basically say there's a process and that process will unfold. And that may mean that some folks can't get their money back. It certainly means consumers don't get any relief, right? It's a question of whether or not importers can get refunds. And I would expect that some would, but that some might have a hard time getting that.
Yeah, and this gets back to a point earlier that the Trump administration clearly has a plan B, C, D, and E, or at least they've said they will. I heard Commerce Secretary Lutnick on Bloomberg yesterday morning sort of saying that the administration fully expects to win, but if it loses, it has plenty of other tools for achieving very similar outcomes. And I think that also, by the way, loomed in the background a bit, that perhaps it would make it more likely the justices could rule against the administration's use of IEPA here because of the other statutes. Some have procedural hoops to go through, like Section 301 or Section 232. Some have time limits. I'm losing track of numbers. I was told there's no math on this exam. Was it Section 122 that has like the 150-day limit, or maybe that was 338? But also, as Jonathan Googles it for me, you know, there is also the fact that the administration might well move ahead with less clear sort of legal basis. They've been undertaking bilateral negotiations for an entire year, and they may well say that for many cases, a deal is a deal, that the foreign country could basically make people whole in lieu of the federal government. We just don't know. And we also don't know, by the way, this is the premise of one of the questions, if individual plaintiffs, so to speak, would want to litigate, either because they can't afford it, or maybe on the other end of the spectrum, because they are enormously large companies that could treat this as a sunk cost rather than picking a fight with an administration. We just don't know. My guess is, as Professor Adler says, the court, if they rule against the administration on the merits, will largely just send this back for the lower courts, the Court of Federal Claims, to sort out both the jurisdictional and merits issues in the first instance.
I think that's right. I mean, there are, and we did have a question in the box about this. You know, there are a lot of other statutes that give a lot of other authorities. What's interesting, and the Hills brief that I mentioned before notes this, is that even when one looks at what the Nixon precedent, what was done was still in line with the broader fabric of trade law in terms of what sorts of tariffs can be authorized, whereas these are a real departure. And I think that the administration will have lots of tools still on the table, including tariff tools. One thing I'll just note in that regard, and there was a New York Times article on this, that there's a tension in the way the administration has wanted to present this case to the court and publicly. Right? At argument, the Solicitor General talks about, look, if these tariffs are as effective as possible, if they are most effective, they will raise no money. But yet, the brief the Solicitor General filed, the Truth Social posts that the president makes on a regular basis, the other comments made publicly are all about how much money it's bringing in. So it's almost as if the administration is saying, look, we impose all these tariffs and they're not very effective because they're generating money. There is, in fact, a bit of a bait and switch. Now, the thing that's really interesting about that in this context is that traditionally, and this has been true in Trump cases, this has been true in non-Trump cases, the justices are very wary about taking political statements by an administration, whether it's Trump's comment about a Muslim ban or Obama's statement that the individual mandate penalty was not a tax, and holding the government to those statements in the context of a legal case if the government doesn't rely upon them. And what I've wondered about is whether or not both the way the case was argued, but also some of the things in the Solicitor General's brief actually opened that door in a way that it's usually kept closed. And that relates to kind of, does the administration have other options? Because if the goal is reinvigorating American manufacturing, well, quotas and limits on importation do that just as well. If the goal is putting pressure on India with regard to Russia, well, again, all of those other tools can put just as much pressure on India, but those other tools can't offer the possibility of generating revenue for the Treasury. And so I think it'll be interesting how much the justices care about that.
Yeah. And the question you've just mentioned by David Chu, citing Section 232 and Section 301 under different statutes, those are both available. In fact, I think the administration is proceeding with other tariffs under both those statutes right now. But the thing is, they have, as I think David Chu knows, they have a lot of process and they're susceptible to perhaps more judicial review because they have more process. And so one of the reasons it seems why the administration really focused on IEEPA as tariffs is it was because it had less process and it was a better tool for the president to use on the fly in negotiations. John, let's try to get through a few more questions while we have time. Maybe a pair of questions. One from John Becchioni of the New Civil Liberties Alliance, which of course has been deeply involved in these issues, and another by my friend Ted Hurt. John asks whether Roberts, Gorsuch, Thomas, and Barrett might see this as an opportunity to get Democratic appointed justices to join a major questions doctrine decision. And Ted Hurt asks, maybe this is a narrow case, but there could be concurring opinions where the justices would think ahead. I'll tie those together, John, and ask, how do you think the justices will approach this? Will they approach it strategically as a chance to sort of lay down markers for future cases? Or do you think that in this case, the justices will have to kind of stay close to home on a narrow issue in order to cobble together a broader majority?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. I'll make a couple observations. First, it might depend on how much the justices think they have to decide this case quickly, right? If they think this case is on a short fuse, you know, they accelerated the rate at which they heard argument and so on, then that would discourage a lot of separate writing and result counsel something quite narrow. If they don't feel under a lot of pressure, if they're okay issuing this in April, May, June of next year, well, then I expect lots of separate writings. On the point about the liberal justices, you know, it's been observed, I've made this observation, others have certainly before Justice Jackson joined the court, the liberal justices, as a general matter, were always more willing to join opinions that reached the bottom line they liked without having to write separately. Some of them, Justice Ginsburg, for example, noted this publicly, right? She's made multiple comments that Justice Kennedy's Obergefell decision was not the decision she would have written, did not have the rationale she preferred, but the idea was let's get a majority. King versus Burwell, the hints at the major questions doctrine there in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, the liberals joined on because they historically have liked the idea of an opinion speaking for the court having more force. Justice Jackson has shown the instinct to want to go it alone more than, say, Kagan or Sotomayor. And so I think that scrambles it a little bit. And I am confident the Chief Justice wants there to be opinion that has at least five, in his view, ideally six or seven justices on board. And that may be difficult if, you know, he wants to write a major questions type decision and Justice Jackson is holding out for, you know, legislative history or something. In terms of looking forward, I do think there will be a lot in the opinion, again, especially if the Chief Justice writes, that tries to limit its implications for other scenarios, right? Limit its implication for the president's ability to use other tools. I would think most justices would go along with that, but, you know, Justice Jackson likes to write on her own, and certainly some of the conservatives do as well.
That's a really interesting point. I like that a lot. Let me ask, I'll go to another question here. We have a question from Stephen Dewey and then a couple of related questions from Jeffrey Wood. So we'll start with Stephen Dewey. And he asks about the underlying factual question here. You know, is there an economic emergency, or more broadly, how should the courts even think about these emergency declarations that have become so predominant in American government, not just under IEPA, but as Stephen says, there's been no economic downturns since the 2021 pandemic, and we've had large trade deficits forever. It's hard to think of them as an emergency. But of course, the courts have always tended to be deferential to presidents, these sorts of things. And I wonder, I wonder how sustainable that is too. Presidents keep making these emergency declarations and other sort of factual findings that seem increasingly contested across administrations. And by the way, Jonathan, district courts, I think, have been putting more weight on their own factual findings as a way to hem in the Supreme Court. You know, we've seen for the last few years, the court try to simultaneously grapple with energetic agencies and executive branch and governors and energetic district judges. And we've seen those trends kind of collide in things like the nationwide injunction issue. And I don't think it'd be exactly the same way, but I do think the justices are going to increasingly bristle at the factual findings, contestable factual findings of district judges and the factual assertions of the executive. And I do wonder if at some point, not this year, not next year, but in the next 5, 10, 20 years, if the court will have to have some kind of recalibration of how facts work in the administrative process and in judicial review.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's a lot of pressure there. I mean, the court generally gives the executive branch a presumption of regularity. And that's particularly true when we're talking about this, determinations made by the president. It's one thing to say to an agency, you've got to engage in reasoned decision making. You've got to show your work. The president's not an agency. President is not subject to the APA. The court is very reluctant to impose that restriction on the president. And I think the reason there's not much discussion about whether or not this is a real emergency is because the court doesn't want to be in the position, and I think even more, does not want to license district courts to be in the position of second-guessing whether or not what the president said on a given day is the real reason that the administration adopted a particular policy. And I think the court's concerned about what district courts will do with that. I think it's also comes from a recognition that administrations often do things for multiple reasons. Yeah. And trying to second guess and pick apart why a president did X as opposed to Y is just not something that it wants courts to be in the business of doing. Now, that said, we've seen cases where that's broken. The census case is, I think, a good example. I think we've also seen cases where the court was influenced by its suspicion that the president wasn't being fully candid. I think the COVID OSHA vaccinator test opinion is an example of that, where those atmospherics make the court a little more rigorous in its analysis of what the administration is doing, but does so without actually challenging the president's ability to say, I believe there is an emergency. And I think that will hold here, but I certainly agree with you that that's under increasing pressure as the executive branch tries to push the envelope there.
And then last question, really a trio of questions from Jeffrey Wood, all centered around IEPA itself. He asks, could this be a case where the court would declare IEPA unconstitutional under the non-delegation doctrine? I'll just say, I think that's very unlikely. It's not one of the questions presented, if I remember correctly. Is it one of the questions presented?
There is a pure non-delegation question before the court, and it is briefed. But I just yeah, I I agree with you. I don't think the court will get there. The court might use a constitutional avoidance argument.
Yeah, it'll inform the interpretation. It'll inform the interpretation. Now, I wouldn't be surprised to see one or more justices say in a separate opinion, this shows why the statute and this controversy exemplifies why we should rethink non-delegation. Jeffrey also asks, maybe this is like a war powers resolution where the president could act under IEPA, then Congress could ratify or not. And I'll just say, it is true that Congress could enact new tariff statutes, and maybe they will, for all we know, after this. I think it's unlikely. But I don't think the court is in a position to effectively read into this the enforcement mechanism that was there in the War Powers Act, especially when, frankly, that one increasingly seems like dead letter and unworkable to begin with.
Yeah, really, really quick on that. I mean, when this power in IEPA was given to the president, it was before INS versus Chadha, and right. There actually was a mechanism whereby Congress could take back emergency power without having to go through a presentment, without giving the president a chance to veto it. And this came up in argument, and I forget which justice pointed out, but that observation can cut in two ways, right? One way it cuts is Congress would not have given this broad a power if it couldn't have still checked it. But the flip side of that is, then Congress maybe did give this much power. And all the other statutes that were affected by INS versus Chadha have been left undisturbed with broad delegations. And so it's really not clear which way that cuts, but Congress certainly could do that. The problem is that Congress doesn't really have that mechanism here. And last point, Justice Gorsuch noted that there's a ratchet effect in the sense that if Congress thinks the president has too much power here, it has to go through bicameralism and presentment. It has to worry about a veto. It arguably has to worry about a filibuster. But if Congress strikes this down, and Neil Katchal pointed this out, Congress could probably use reconciliation, so a simple majority vote, to give the president tariffing authority as a fiscal tool. And that ratchet effect is something that might, certainly was on Justice Gorsuch's mind. It may influence other justices as well.
And I know we're up on time. I just want to point out really quickly, it's interesting that Justice Gorsuch made that point. He clerked for Justice White, who in INS v. Chadha really rang the alarm and said, by getting rid of these legislative vetoes, you have turbocharged the presidency and left it with all sorts of delegated powers it surely never would have received from Congress if Congress had known there wouldn't be a legislative veto. Similarly, earlier you referred to Chief Justice Roberts and Dames and Moore versus Regan. As you know, Chief Justice Roberts was at the time that case decided a clerk for Justice Rehnquist, who wrote the majority opinion in Dames and Regan. So Chief Justice Roberts probably knows that opinion well. Really quickly, we're over time, but just in a word, Jeffrey Wood, his last question was, doesn't it seem strange that the court might read IEPA as allowing really draconian remedies like total prohibitions on trade while not allowing the lesser remedy of tariffs? This gets back to something in oral argument. I think Justice Kavanaugh said this creates kind of a donut hole where you have these big powers to stop trade, but not the powers to tax it. The Oregon Solicitor General came back with my favorite line, sort of mixing the metaphor. He said, it's not a donut hole, it's a different kind of pastry. And that brings us back to that original framing. Yeah. Will the court see tariffs as like something slightly less than outright prohibitions on trade, you know, of a kind, but just less? Or will they see tariffs as actually different, qualitatively different than even an outright sanction or block on a trade? Any last words on that, Jonathan, before we wrap?
No. I think it really does come down to that. I mean, again, personally, I think the responses that the Oregon Solicitor General and Neil Katchal made about that concern, I happen to think are right. That is to say, there is actually a full menu of tools that IEPA allows, various sorts of quota and licensing regimes can achieve the same import restriction effects as a tariff, and in fact, are arguably even more nimble than a tariff, because if you're concerned about, say, the effects on manufacturing, at some degree, you're concerned about the volume of stuff coming in from overseas, not whether or not the Treasury gets a payment. The only thing different about a tariff is the Treasury getting a payment. You know, I think that that's a meaningful difference as someone that spends a lot of time thinking about instrument choice in regulatory policy and the like. I'm not confident the justices will accept that argument, but I do think it is one of the central questions here. And, you know, at some point between now and July 1st, I guess we'll know.
Yeah. And between now and then, everybody, please read Jonathan's two pieces, his piece after oral argument for the Dispatch and his piece before oral argument for the Wall Street Journal. In addition to thanking him, I want to thank everybody who joined in with great questions. And I'll turn it back over to Libby to wrap things up.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much for joining today and for sharing your insights. I, for one, am very interested to see how this decision turns out, and I know I'm not the only one. So if you're interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website at fedsoc.org. That is FEDSOC.org, or feel free to send us your feedback. We always love to hear it at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.